What's better than a Friday? Why, a Jobs Day Friday, of course. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday, as I said, today, the 6th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Jobs Day, as I also said, 428,000 new jobs last month. 3.6% on the unemployment rate. That much you've surely heard already. Also, Fed week, a 50 basis point. That is the geeky way to say half a percentage point increase in the Fed short-term interest rate. So, I don't know, 7, maybe 8 minutes to talk about what it all means. Neil Richardson's at ADP. Catherine Rempel is at the Washington Post. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, let's see. Catherine, do me a favor. Pick your favorite data point of the jobs report today and discuss.
My favorite data point, I guess, is the fact that we've had roughly a half a million jobs added per month over the past year, which means that if that pace were to roughly continue, we would be back to the pre-pandemic level of jobs in about 2 months, 2 or 3 months. If April pace continued or, you know, the average pace over the past year, we would have filled in the hole, essentially dug at the very beginning of the pandemic, which is quite a remarkable feat, given how long it took to recover from the Great Recession.
And how deep the jobs hole was back in March, April of 2020.
Exactly. Yeah. It was a lot deeper this time.
Right.
And the
right.
forecasts were that it would take much longer to recover all of that lost ground.
Okay, Neela, I am not actually going to give you your choice of data points because I want you to talk about wages as they are reflected in this morning's report, please.
Yes, yeah, so wages went up by 5.5%. Mm-hmm. That was slightly less than the 5.6% 12-month growth rate posted over the last report. Why is that important? Those numbers look very, very close together. Yeah. Well, it's important because that is front and center for the Federal Reserve when they're thinking about inflation. What they are trying to avoid is that wages keep going up and up and up, which we all like, let's be honest. Mm-hmm. But it goes up in a way that drives up inflation, which we don't like, because that means our pay increases, we don't get to feel that because inflation takes it all away from us. So that the fact that those wage increases went down a little bit in this month's report is actually good news for the Fed when they're trying to fight inflation.
Avoiding that dreaded wage price spiral. Then, in fact, Chair Powell talked about it a little bit. Catherine, let me ask you about Jay Powell and the press conference that he had on Wednesday and this thing that he did at the top, which I don't think he's ever done before, which is, you know, he said, thank you very much for coming, blah, 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 good to be here. And then he said, before he took any questions or read his statement, he said, I want to talk directly to the American people. In almost literally those words. Why do you think he did that?
I think he did that because he wants to show that the Fed is in touch with the real pain being felt by the public, that they're not a bunch of disconnected propeller heads, you know, who work in abstractions, that he and his colleagues pay attention to the needs and pressures and frustrations of regular Americans, whether that means their ability to get a job on the one hand, you know, half of the dual mandate being maximum employment, and their ability to keep up with the cost of living, the other half of their mandate being stable prices. So, you know, I think they're trying to show that this is not, you know, an abstraction for federal Fed policymakers. This is actually about weighing these very difficult choices that they have to weigh, so that regular Americans can feel okay.
I love the propeller heads thing, and let's just hope central bankers do not take offense when they listen to this program. Neela, let me ask you this: if what the Fed wants to do is drive down inflation as quickly as possible without, of course, sending this economy into a recession, the soft landing that we've talked about a lot. Why do you suppose Chair Powell, when asked about why they didn't do a 75 basis point, that is to say 3/4 percentage point increase, why do you think he basically took that off the table and he said, no, we're not thinking about it. It's only a half percentage point as far as we can see. Why did he do that?
I'm just going to guess on this.
Okay. Well, we're all guessing, right?
I mean, you know. I think the Fed wants to make it look easy what they're doing.
Really?
And one of the things that it's about credibility, that they have this in check. And the one thing that has worked for the Fed in bringing down inflation is gradualism, the ability to raise by the same amount each Fed meeting. Usually it's a quarter of a point. Mm-hmm. And that rate hike, gradual, slow, predictable, has been the game plan. They wanted to do the same thing, I think, this time around, but with a slightly more aggressive stance, 50 basis points, a half a percentage point, but predictable every single time, at least for the next couple of meetings. And so I think that was behind taking away a higher, more aggressive push, but it didn't work as well in doing so.
Well,
as
yeah.
we saw in the market this week.
Well, exactly. So we'll get to that in a second. But Catherine, talk to me about the Fed's credibility. I mean, even Jay Powell, you know, he gave a sidelong glance at the fact that they've been behind the curve for, you know, controlling inflation. Do you think they have a credibility problem?
I mean, if you look at inflation expectations, they're not dramatically higher.
Yeah.
So one way to interpret that is that people think inflation will come down, ergo the Fed is going to be able to take the punch bowl away
right.
at some point. I mean, I think for a very long time, nobody thought about inflation because we hadn't experienced inflation.
Yeah, sure.
But and that is to the credit of the credibility of the Fed, among other among other factors. But you know, that was obviously not the case in the pre-Volcker era. And part of the reason why Volcker had to raise interest rates so dramatically was to show the world that the Fed was actually finally serious about getting inflation under control, that they almost had to like overreact to prove to the world that price stability is something that they care about. And then it becomes, once the central bank has that credibility, it almost becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that if you believe the Fed is going to take the punch bowl away, they almost like don't have to take it away as quickly.
Hmm.
And we're in this funny situation right now where there is more skepticism about the Fed's choices made over the past year. And I think that they're trying their best to show the world that they are competent, but they are humble, you know, to use the other word that Powell uses all the time. Humble and nimble, I think, are his two favorite words now.
I think that's right.
But I'm guessing that they're worried about it because they've gotten a lot of calls wrong in this past year, and inflation has been much higher than people are comfortable with and then they predicted.
So, Neela, let's talk for a second about the punch bowl. Of course, you know, the Fed's job is to take the punch bowl away just as the party really gets rocking. And we saw in the markets the last couple of days that whole whiplash thing. Sudeep, when we called him yesterday to talk about the crazy day on Wall Street, he said, look, people have been staggering around drunk for a while now and they're taking the punch bowl away. What effect does that volatility and the uncertainty that everybody who, you know, doesn't follow the bigger economy, but they look at stocks every day and say, oh, my goodness, things are crazy. What effect do you think that uncertainty has?
You know, Catherine mentioned expectations, and I think that's such an important part of the Fed's decision making. The technical thing that volatility does is feed back into financial conditions, which is another technical term you'll hear a lot, but that's basically the tightening of borrowing costs. And so in some sense, the fact that interest rates are going up, but also that the easy money is a thing of the past is something that the stock market is starting to figure that out and kind of readjust to. But that spills back onto Main Street in terms of small business loans and mortgage loans. And so that's all part of this mix of the economy coming to terms with the reality of higher interest rates in a way that they have not, we have not experienced in a very long time.
Neela Richardson at ADP, Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post. What a week it was. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks,
you too.
Ty.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today. So look, after the last couple of days, as we were just talking about, we will just say today was, you know, calm, relatively. Details, numbers, when we get there. If you take a step back and look around at all of the economic agita, both here and globally, right? Inflation, supply chain, the markets, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The American labor market does seem to be the bright spot. We've gotten back, as we talked about a minute ago, almost all of the 20 or maybe 22 million jobs we lost at the beginning of the pandemic. Unemployment's the lowest it's been since Richard Nixon was in the White House. But the good news part of the job story, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now, depends very much on what kind of work you do and how much you get paid to do it.
There's a growing jobs recovery gap between private employers that have the ability to raise wages fast in response to the tight labor market and government employers that mostly don't. Julia Pollack is chief economist at ZipRecruiter.
The private sector has recovered more than 90% of the jobs lost in the pandemic, the public sector only around 60%.
She says it's a lot of state and local education jobs, bus drivers, cafeteria workers, and especially teachers.
Our schools particularly have failed to recover. Lots of teachers have retired, and schools are not figuring out a way to get them back yet.
One big reason, she says, is wages. They're growing twice as fast in the private sector, and wage growth has lagged especially in the more heavily unionized public sector.
Unionized workers, when they come back to the negotiating table, are going to demand large cost of living increases and more because their working environment has been so tough in recent years.
That's also holding back nursing care facilities, says Haley Brown at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
They are still over 200,000 workers short of February of 2020.
Again, the jobs are stressful and risky and don't pay much.
The pandemic was really hard on those who worked in nursing care facilities, and it's difficult for them to compete for workers in a tight labor market and raise wages as needed.
Brown says child care center employment is still down by more than 100,000, and that packs a double whammy.
We want people to have jobs in childcare, but also because the childcare industry is essential for mothers' labor force participation specifically to come back to pre-pandemic levels.
In fact, pretty much wherever you look in the economy, it's hardest to fill the lowest paid jobs. Becky Frankowitz at staffing firm Manpower Group says at $13 and $15 an hour, workers aren't sticking around.
You really don't see the quit rates start to fall until you hit about $17 an hour.
She says workers want higher pay and more flexibility to set their schedule or work remotely. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
To women's basketball we go now. The 2022 WNBA season tips off tonight. Last year's champion Chicago Sky hosting the Los Angeles Sparks. Viewership for last year's finals up more than 40% from just 2 years earlier. And the league has increased the number of games teams will play this year to 36, thanks to that growing popularity and fan interest. Now, more eyeballs, of course, means more brands wanting to attach their names to the league and to its players. So, from the business of sports desk, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on what that influx of cash might mean.
The WNBA's attendance and TV numbers are up from where they were, but they're still nowhere near what NBA games are pulling. David Broughton's a research director at the Sports Business Journal.
Every commissioner from the current one to the original one has said our number one obstacle is we need more fans.
The question is, and always has been, how to get them. Angeline Scheinbaum at Clemson University says it starts with more media attention.
First, we've got to think about how to get more advertising dollars and more airtime. And that definitely is correlated and will correlate more with equity investments and sponsor investments.
And those advertising dollars do seem to finally be rolling in. The league opens tonight with a record 38 sponsors. U.S. Bank signed a deal in March to call itself the WNBA's official bank. And whereas many WNBA sponsorship deals have been add-ons to those made with the men's league, U.S. Bank's sponsorship is just with the women's league. Allison Lowenstein teaches marketing at Siena College.
Brands are looking for ways to create communities, right? It's not just put your brand out there and, oh my God, people are going to, you know, come to it. They have to really think about how are we going to build a community?
A community that will grow. And Angeline Scheinbaum at Clemson says what might be even more important for some consumers is that these brands call out inequity for women's sports.
Which we see really just in the last 2 years alone, a huge spike in the number of people and consumers, especially younger generations, who find that really important.
Now, advertisers are certainly recognizing that, but David Broughton at the Sports Business Journal says the WNBA sponsorship revenue growth goes beyond brands just seeking good PR.
They're not in it to lose money. I think everyone's figured out that, yes, we can do the right thing, and we can make money doing it.
After all, he says those things are not mutually exclusive. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Because it's kind of hard times right now.
Kind of is for a whole lot of people. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 98 points today, 0.3%, 32,899. The NASDAQ gave back 173 points, about 1.4%. Closed at 12,144. The S&P 500 got rid of 23 points, about 0.5%, 41.23 there. For the week, the Dow lost almost 0.25%. The NASDAQ off 1.5%. S&P 500 dipped about 0.2%. Under Armour, get this, tumbled nearly 24% today on weaker than expected first quarter sales. Staying sporty, Peloton dropped 7.7%. Today, Zillow down 4.3% despite first quarter profit and revenue, the top forecast. The company said the present real estate environment is uncertain, about which, backing that up, Gallup's annual economy and personal finance poll conducted in April showed just 30% of U.S. adults surveyed said it was a good time to buy. There was a record low. 69% said it was a bad time. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay. Jobs. Blah, 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 right? You've heard all you needed to hear? Well, hang on. Because, look, the labor market in this country is still hot, record hot, in fact. But there are some signs it's slowing down. And as Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports, that might not be such a bad thing.
The U.S. is closing in on what's known as full employment. That's when all the people who want to work and can are working. Mark Zandi at Moody's says right about now would be a good time for job growth to slow down.
We're creating a lot of jobs, so many jobs.
Zandi expects the economy will reach full employment in the next few months before blowing right past it.
And that's a problem if you're in a world of high inflation. You know, this would mean the economy will potentially overheat.
Because inflation can get worse, he says, as workers demand higher wages, a cycle that can start to feed on itself. Today's jobs report shows wage growth slowing down. That's a sign that there might not actually be a labor shortage, says Kate Bonn, chief economist at Equitable Growth.
So the fact that Black unemployment is still nearly twice what it is for white unemployment, women's employment rates have plateaued.
Bonn says if the labor market were really so hot,
we would be pulling in those people who are typically facing barriers, and they're not being pulled in as much.
She thinks there's plenty of room for this job market to grow as it comes off years of income inequality and wages that have been stuck in a rut. The labor market is making up ground lost over the last 2 years, says Gus Fauché, chief economist at PNC.
We still are down by about 1.2 million jobs from where we were before the pandemic, so the labor market has not fully recovered.
But better wages are helping draw workers back, especially prime-age workers between 25 and 54 years old. That's according to Joseph Brisuelis, chief economist at RSM.
And that in itself is a sign of a growing confidence among workers.
He says as the Fed raises rates, the economy will cool, and with it, hiring, which could help get inflation under control. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
This has been, with some merit, I think, a very jobs-heavy show today. So that is where we'll go out, with the job of working the powwow circuit. Powwows draw competitive native dancers and singers from all over the continent, and there is an economy that's been built up around them, prize money changing hands, and vendors who make their living on the circuit, selling everything from Indian tacos to high-end jewelry. The Gathering of Nations powwow returned to Albuquerque this year for the first time since 2019. People from hundreds of tribes taking in the sights and sounds. Marketplace's Savannah Marr talked to some of the sellers about how they made it through the pandemic and how it's been getting back in the game.
At the first Gathering of Nations in 2 years, most of the attention is on the dance arena. But between contests, folks make their way over to the vendors' tables and shop for everything from ribbon skirts and Pueblo pottery to wampum jewelry, made from the purple part of a quahog shell. That's what Pequot artist Dan Simons is selling at his booth. 2 years ago, when the first big powwow was canceled, he wasn't sure his business would survive.
I was sitting on my couch, you know, that evening, just like, what am I going to do? Because there was no outlets for my work.
That evening on the couch, he had an idea.
I just started this group on Facebook
called Social Distance Powwow. And within days, hundreds of dancers, singers, vendors, and spectators joined.
1 week later, there was thousands. 2 weeks later, there was even hundreds of thousands.
Giving Native artists a place to market their work.
If I didn't have that page, being able to, you know, even grow my own business audience through that, I wouldn't have made it.
Now, Simons is back to his old face-to-face, on-the-road business model. A model that's gotten a lot more expensive.
Cost of even me getting here, you know, the gas was, you know, hundreds of dollars coming here. This booth space alone was $750.
Costs that add up when you're traveling to a different powwow every weekend and when the job can take you from Colorado to Connecticut to Manitoba all in one season. And many vendors here at Gathering of Nations are paying a lot more for materials, too.
You have your beads, you have your thread, your leather.
At her booth, Navajo beadwork artist Loretta Benali is selling things like earrings and medallions. She says adjusting prices to meet her rising costs has been tricky. Some non-native tourists see a $60 price tag on hand-beaded jewelry and get sticker shock.
Some of them that don't know a whole lot about it, they'll come and they'll say, wow, that's really pricey, you know?
Back home in Nebraska, Benali also beads custom-ordered regalia sets that take weeks or months to finish. And the market for those pricier pieces, the kind worn by dancers at powwows, is kind of limited. Even with her costs rising, Benali can't charge more than those dancers are able to pay.
If somebody's really into something and down on their luck, you know, I'll give them a break because it's kind of hard times right now.
For Eastern Shoshone artist Joanne Brings Thunder, it's clear the powwow community is on a tighter budget.
The disposable income at this show is just not there.
Brings Thunder makes narrative art on historic ledger paper, her take on the historic Plains drawing style. She also makes jewelry and has her own line of textiles. Luxuries, she says, some folks can't afford at this year's Gathering of Nations.
I think the gas prices and the food costs, just the cost of living just to survive, is definitely hitting people's pocketbooks.
Looking at a potentially slow sales season at in-person events, Brings Thunder is glad she focused on her online presence during the pandemic.
On Facebook and Instagram, I can post something and it's usually sold pretty quickly. My customers watch for that. If I'm not at a powwow they're at, they'll hit me up.
She fears events like Gathering of Nations just aren't accessible anymore to young Native artists just starting out. Her advice for those artists? Market your work on social media before you hit the powwow trail. In Albuquerque, I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which comes with a reminder that you've still got a little bit of time left before Mother's Day. This item from Bloomberg, citing data from Open Table Mother's Day restaurant bookings. I'm thinking brunches, but maybe dinner too. I don't know. Anyway, those reservations are up 13% from 2021. Makes sense, right? People still just getting vaxxed. But bookings are up 39% from 2019, the before times, in other words. So, you know, make your reservations now, huh? All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context in keeping with the policy of this program that if we stop talking about this stuff, we're going to stop talking about it. The headline April unemployment rate, you already know, 3.6%. For whites in this economy, it is 3.2%. For black Americans, as Lily's piece alluded to, 5.9%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a nice weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.